the Clean Water Act was specifically intended to halt the practice of using lakes, rivers, and streams as industrial pollution waste dumps.
A big loss for environmental groups at the Supreme Court. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 22nd of June. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a midday jolt in South Central Alaska.
It rocked and rolled us pretty good.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of a midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
The Supreme Court has sided with a mining company, saying it can dump tailings from the Kensington gold mine into a lake near Juneau. In its 6-3 decision, the court said the permit issued to mining company Core Alaska by the Army Corps of Engineers is valid. The company has a permit to put 4.5 million tons of mine waste into Lower Slate Lake, which would raise the lake's bottom elevation about 50 feet. It would kill all fish and most other aquatic life. However, the permit calls for the lake to be restored once the mine closes. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council sued the Army Corps of Engineers, saying the permit wasn't in accordance with the law because the mining company's permit should come from the Environmental Protection Agency. SEAC argued that the waste is a pollutant, not merely fill. The Supreme Court disagreed and said the permit should indeed come from the Army Corps, and it's up to the Army Corps to make the judgment call. The court also said SEAC did not offer a viable alternative to the lake dumping plan. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority's opinion. Coeur d'Alene Mines Corporation spokesman Tony Ebersole says today's decision should allow the Kensington mine to move forward.
The decision, we think, clears the way for the only item that remains to be constructed at the mine, the tailings facility, and for production to commence at the mine. It's also, I think, a decision confirms that the permitted plan, which has been thoroughly studied, is lawful and the best environmental choice.
Earth Justice Attorney Tom Waldo argued the environmentalist's side before the Supreme Court. He calls today's decision unfortunate.
The decision does not serve the purposes of the Clean Water Act. The purpose of the Clean Water Act is to keep America's waters safe for drinking, fishing, and swimming. The Clean Water Act was specifically intended to halt the practice of using lakes, rivers, and streams as industrial pollution waste dumps.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg agreed with the environmental groups and wrote the dissenting opinion. She said it should be up to the EPA to regulate what goes into the lake, not the Army Corps. Ginsburg wrote that the majority's reading strains credulity and that a discharge of a pollutant should not become lawful just because it is solid material and will fill up the bottom of a lake. She's concerned about the precedent the case may set and wrote that whole categories of regulated industries can thereby gain immunity from a variety of pollution control standards. Tom Waldo with Earth Justice agrees the decision could have wide-ranging impacts.
Justice Ginsburg's dissent also recognizes that today's decision opens an enormous loophole for any kind of industrial discharge that contains a high level of solids. That has an immediate impact, of course, for mining because mining discharges inherently contain a high level of solids in them. But there are lots of other industries that also generate high quantities of solids in their waste.
As for what the decision means for the Kensington mine, Waldo hopes the permit, which was issued during the Bush administration, will now be reevaluated. The Kensington Gold Mine is about 45 miles north of Juneau. The number of workers at the mine is expected to gradually ramp up in the coming months as Core Alaska gets its tailings permit back and construction resumes. Randy Wanamaker is director of BBC Human Resource Development Corporation. That's a company devoted to placing natives and other Southeast residents with jobs at the mine. Wanamaker is also deputy mayor of Juneau.
I'm very pleased with this decision. You know, the environmental organizations have had their day in court. The verdict has been carefully rendered by the Supreme Court, and it upholds the permits for the Kensington project. This is an opportunity for the environmental groups to sit down now and honor their pledge to help open this mine. You know, they can avoid creating any further delay by not asking for reconsideration of the Supreme Court verdict and just delaying the inevitable.
At the peak of construction, there were as many as 400 people working at the Kensington mine. Now only a tenth that number are on site maintaining equipment and facilities. Another 41 employees were laid off in October to minimize pre-production costs. 200 people are needed for actual operation of the mine starting late next year. Average pay is just over $80,000 plus retirement and benefits. A strong earthquake rattled South Central Alaska today. The 5.4 magnitude quake was centered about 50 miles north of Anchorage. The Regional Earthquake Information Center hasn't received any damage reports, but the shaking did provide a midday adrenaline boost for many Alaskans. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
South Central Alaska began rumbling at 11:28. The tiny community of Squintna was closest to the earthquake's epicenter, about 17 miles away. Many residents there reported small items falling off of walls as their homes shook. Joyce Logan owns a lodge in town. She says there was no real damage to her building, but the earthquake was one of the strongest she's felt in more than three decades.
It rocked and rolled us pretty good. My crystals in my windows was going from side to side to side to side. The pictures was kind of crooked after it got done.
The lodge's only guest took notice of the earthquake, too.
I got one upstairs sleeping. And, yeah, he woke up. It woke him up good.
Anchorage residents also felt an unnervingly long series of rumblings that turned out to be harmless. The Alaska Earthquake Information Center says the damage was probably limited because the earthquake was so deep, 33 miles below the Earth's surface. Natasha Rupert is a seismologist at the center.
People report that some the objects on shelves were rattled, some pictures on the walls were kind of shaken a little bit, but so far I've seen no reports of structural damage to the houses or to big structures.
Earthquakes of a similar magnitude are common in Alaska. The Aleutian Islands have recorded at least one quake that was even stronger today, and another that was close. But the one near Anchorage was unusual because it occurred close to the state's largest population center. Rupert says she's gotten calls from CNN and other national media outlets.
We have a magnitude 5 earthquake somewhere in the state. On of this magnitude every other week, maybe. And I think because it was felt so widely in Anchorage and greater Anchorage area, I think this is why the media picked up on this story.
Squintna Roadhouse owner Joyce Logan is hoping the earthquake isn't a sign that stronger rumblings in her area are on their way. Natasha Rupert says it's impossible to predict what will happen next.
It's hard to tell if any particular earthquake is going to be followed by a larger earthquake. In 50%, it might be followed by a larger event. In other 50%, it might not. So we can't really say if this is the precursor to anything more significant or not.
There have been several smaller aftershocks since the morning quake. The largest was magnitude 4. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering an Alaska politician who loved baseball.
People knew the Fairbanks Gold Panthers, and they knew it not only because they were a good team, but also because of Red's enthusiasm.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848.
Two men spent 52 hours drifting in the Bering Sea before being rescued by the Coast Guard on Sunday evening. 50-year-old Rod Whitehead of ADAC and 35-year-old Bill Osterback of Sand Point hit the motor of their 15-foot hard-bottomed Zodiac on a rock while they were making a run to Amatignak Island, about 130 miles southwest of ADAC. Whitehead says the boat lost power and the strong current pulled them away from the island at about 3 p.m. on Friday.
The first 15 hours we paddled, trying to get to land, but the currents were too strong. And the places we were actually able to get to land was too dangerous, you know. It definitely would have killed us on the rocks.
The two men operated the Larissa M, a 50-foot fishing vessel that was hired by a group of surveyors working on remote islands and documenting old Aleut village sites. They used their low-power radio to contact the four surveyors who were on the island. No one was on the Larissa M. It was anchored offshore, and it held the only radio capable of calling in help from the Coast Guard.
I called them on the radio and told them that they needed to take materials off the beach and make a raft in order to, you know, get the Coast Guard to come.
The surveyors gathered together old nets, buoys, and boards from around the small island to build a makeshift raft and oars and to get to the boat. It took them until almost 10 p.m. the next day. In the meantime, the two men continued to try to paddle to shore.
You know, about during the dark hours on the first night, both him and I were rowing, and we'd be nodding off every now and then as we were rowing, and we were just exhausted by that point.
They finally realized that they wouldn't be able to get the 1,500-pound Zodiac to shore, so they tried sleeping in the boat despite the waves. The chances of running into another boat in the Amchitka Pass were very slim. They rationed their food.
We had one bottle of water, and we had one Clif Bar. So Saturday, we each ate a quarter Clif Bar, took a couple sips of water, and Sunday, we did the same.
Though the weather was cold enough to see their breath and they were soaked with water, Whitehead said they stayed positive.
We saw a seagull land on the boat at one point, and Bill and I both looked at him and thought about having some sea chicken, you know, but we didn't.
On Sunday morning, they could hear planes circling above them. When the weather cleared that afternoon, they waved anything they could in the air until the Coast Guard C-130 aircraft found them and dropped them supplies, like a better radio, survival suits, and food.
It was like Christmas when we received that.
By 8 p.m. Sunday evening, a Coast Guard helicopter arrived at the scene and hoisted the two men to safety. Prince of Wales Island is losing a well-known player in the cultural and scientific world. Archaeologist Terry Fifield has decided to leave Alaska and relocate to the White Mountain National Forest in New Hampshire. As KRBD's Jay Marble reports, Fifield is widely admired for his handling of sensitive cultural matters.
Fifield does like to talk about archaeology, the things it reveals about ancient people, the changing climate. He says when he first got into this business, he had a principle in his thinking. He wasn't going to worry about money, and he was going to have fun. He says that's the way it turned out. He says almost everybody has an interest in archaeology, and they often want to discuss their views and ideas.
Archaeology as a profession is something that you can talk to everybody about, and so there's always a topic of conversation to get into with people. Lots of people want to talk to you because they've had some experience, or they have an idea, or they have seen something that they want to talk about. And so that way it's great. It ties you into people. It ties you into history. It, you know, the trick with me, I think, is to make it relevant to the present and the future. And that being able to do that, I think, really keeps people intrigued, too.
Fifield became the archaeologist for both districts on Prince of Wales Island. The last 15 or so years have involved him in some very exciting finds. In 1994, Fifield was supervising an employee named Dave Putnam. They were looking for old raised marine beaches, part of an effort to study sea level changes. They were on state land on the Thorn River when Putnam discovered fabric sticking out of the bank. They had the material dated, and it turned out to be the oldest fabric ever discovered in the Pacific Northwest. It
turned out to be about 6,000 years old, and that was my first involvement in a really significant find, and that put us in touch with a lot of different archaeologists up and down the coast, with the public through the media, with the state of Alaska because it was on state land, not on Forest Service land, and with the native community because we went for help and tried to share that information as broadly as we could.
Seeking help and assistance from the native community is something that Fifield did often. Millie Schoonover is a past president of the Craig Community Association, a local tribal group. She remembers when Fifield first arrived and started meeting with the tribes and asking about how he could best go about doing his work.
And boy, let me tell you, we are definitely going to miss him. He's going to be a great loss as far as working with tribal people. You couldn't ask for a better person.
Terry Fifield will leave Prince of Wales Island in early July. I'm Jay Marble.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river.
The U.S. Supreme Court today refused to declare part of the Federal Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. The litigation originated in Austin, Texas, with an attempt to avoid the requirement that election-related decisions get Department of Justice approval before they are allowed to take effect. The approval, called pre-clearance, is one of the federal government's major tools in combating voter discrimination, and Alaska is one of only a few states that must meet that requirement. By not declaring it unconstitutional, the decision opens the way for an Alaska voting rights case to continue in federal court. Nick versus Bethel was brought by four tribal councils and four elders in 2007 against the city of Bethel and the State Division of Elections. Natalie Landreth is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund in Anchorage.
These plaintiffs are alleging that the state of Alaska does not provide adequate assistance as required by law to non-English-speaking voters. Now, the reason this is important is if you or I travel to any other city in the United States, take, for example, Los Angeles, or if we went to Albuquerque, when we go vote, we'll see a ballot in Spanish. In some of the pueblos in New Mexico, you'll see them in native languages. But up here in Alaska, despite the very large percentage of Yupik speakers, there was nothing for Yupik speakers.
Landreth says Yupik is the largest non-English-speaking population in the state, and the complaint centers on the state's failure to get federal pre-clearance on minority language changes. She says the case was held up by the federal court pending today's decision. State Assistant Attorney General Sarah Felix says the NIC complaints are more procedural than substantive, pointing to nearly 30 years of Yupik voter assistance. The administration is still meeting with citizens and working on translations for ballots. Despite Saturday's cool temperatures, overcast skies, and many other downtown weekend events, Anchorage's annual Gay Pride Parade and Park Strip celebration drew more participants than usual on Saturday. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
As he looked for his group at the staging ground, Tony Glavanik saw this year's parade through downtown as particularly important.
We do have a major ordinance before the assembly, and I think this is just another opportunity for the people of Anchorage to show the assembly and everyone who's watching that this is important to us and that equal rights are important.
For the past 2 weeks, the continuing public hearing over a proposal to include sexual orientation under the city's anti-discrimination ordinance has filled the Anchorage Assembly chambers with hundreds for and against the inclusion. Shirley Rivas is the stepmother of a gay son. Rivas had testified at the Anchorage Assembly's public hearing on the first night and continued to watch the testimony on subsequent evenings.
This day is very important to the gay community because of what's going on in Anchorage, and there's so much vitriol against this ordinance and against the gay community, and I think it's a blot on Anchorage, Alaska.
The community-wide debate seems to have impacted the size of the parade. This year's over two dozen units matched 2001 for size, which also reflected local politics. That year, gay and non-gay groups joined together in reaction to then-Mayor George Wirtz's removal of a gay pride display in the Lusac Library a couple of weeks earlier. A lawsuit forced the mayor to rescind the exhibit ban. Participant Gail Smoke agrees the parade is a chance for gays to reach out for political support, but he says it has even more importance on a personal level.
This is affirmation. I'm 62 years old, and this is my favorite year, a day all year, because I get to march in this parade, and I get to publicly declare that I'm gay, and I'm very proud to be gay, and from the side, you get affirmation.
Part of that affirmation came from people outside the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community who also joined the parade.
We are the Rage City Roller Girls, which is Anchorage's roller derby league. We have a lot of gay fans. We want to show them our support and come out here and skate with them and roll along.
This year's parade included two units from the Matsu Valley, as well as four Anchorage religious groups. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Memorial services are scheduled this week for Red Boucher, Alaska's first elected lieutenant governor and a true Alaska character. Boucher died Friday at his home in Anchorage at the age of 88. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander profiles a small slice of his very full life.
Henry Aristide Red Boucher left his mark on the lieutenant governor's office, the legislature, sports, telecommunications, just about everything he tackled. Those who knew him in public or private life often describe him as passionate, zealous, even a bit fanatical about some things, a man who got things done.
Red was red. You know, there aren't going to be any more individuals like him.
Boucher was Alaska's fourth lieutenant governor, but the first to be elected. He served from 1970 to 74 in the second administration of Governor William Egan. Egan's son Dennis, now Juneau State Senator, recalls at that time that Boucher drove a red Mustang convertible, which sported a vanity plate of the same name, Red, a license plate that appeared on subsequent cars Boucher owned. Alaska's lieutenant governor oversees the Division of Elections, and Boucher knew it had to be a department voters could trust.
As lieutenant governor, he really did bring, I think, a lot of integrity to the Division of Elections in the earlier part of his term.
Mike Miller represented Juneau in the House of Representatives during Boucher's term as lieutenant governor. He says Boucher set a high standard for the division and personally pushed voter registration.
He did more to publicize registration. He always carried around with him in his pocket registration documents. If somebody was eligible, he could whip out his pen and the document and sign them up and get them registered to vote just right on the spot.
But Boucher was never a one-issue guy, and Egan recalls he threw himself into other aspects of the new state, including lobbying Congress for the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. As lieutenant governor, Boucher was truly engaged in the Egan administration.
It wasn't an office down the hall. I mean, he was involved in issues that shaped the state.
And Boucher liked to work closely with the legislature.
I always felt like he was a great assist to the governor, to Bill Egan. He would come down to us and, you know, really present the governor's proposals from time to time, not on every bill, of course, but when it was appropriate. And nobody represented the governor with any more enthusiasm than he did. Everything Red did, as you know, he just gave it 150%.
From 1984 to 1990, he represented Anchorage in the legislature, focusing on connecting all of Alaska through telecommunications.
He dove into that with the same amount of zest.
His zest for politics started in Fairbanks in the 1960s when he served on the city council and later as mayor. It culminated in the 1990s with his election to the Anchorage Assembly. Boucher moved to Alaska in 1958, working for a sporting goods company in Fairbanks and later opening up his own store.
He was a sports fanatic.
Baseball was his game, and Red Boucher founded the Alaska Gold Panners in 1960, the beginning of the Alaska Baseball League. At the time, Mike Miller was a young writer for the State Division of Tourism. He got a letter from the Gold Panners coach.
This letter, and then I guess in a subsequent conversation, he mentioned that he was going to help put Alaska on the map with the Gold Panners. And at the time, I kind of mentally thought to myself, yeah, sure, Red, whoever you are.
But Miller did know about the National Baseball Congress World Series in Wichita, Kansas, which drew teams from coast to coast every summer. Boucher took his team to Wichita for the first time in 1962.
And you know what? I became more and more convinced that he did do a huge job of putting Alaska on the map. He was probably the most enthusiastic coach that any of the teams in Alaska has ever had, and that just spilled over down there in Wichita in the central portion of the nation. People knew the Fairbanks Gold Panthers, and they knew it not only because they were a good team, but also because of Red's enthusiasm.
Earlier this year, he was inducted into the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. According to Hall of Fame directors, Red Boucher is responsible for making baseball in Alaska what it is today.
Way to go, CJ!
That's Red Boucher in the stands at a Juneau Crimson Bears football game in Anchorage. Grandson CJ Keyes was a standout player for the Crimson Bears. This reporter's last interview with the former lieutenant governor, legislator, and telecommunications guru was not about politics or the internet, but about Juneau's success in the Cook Inlet Football Conference. He was 83 then and had not missed a Crimson Bears game played in Anchorage that season, no matter what the weather.
I think it's great for the state to see the smaller communities here in this championship game.
Stories about Red Boucher the statesman, the sportsman, the character, and his passion for Alaska will be told at a memorial on Friday at Change Point Church in Anchorage.
He was totally passionate for rural Alaska, for the major cities. He loved all of Alaska.
Donations in his memory can be made to the H.A. Red Boucher Scholarship Fund at the Alaska Community Foundation. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Jay Marble in Craig, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/CEM. In today's competitive business climate, the advantage lies in reducing cost and increasing efficiencies. A safe and healthy workplace reduces cost and improves productivity. To get started, contact the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Occupational Safety and Health Consultation and Training Program at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.